Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is acclaimed singer-songwriter Teddy Thompson, whose new album, Never Be the Same, is out May 15th via the Royal Potato Family label. Thompson's singular voice as a writer and singer are on full display across the collection as he fuses contemporary sensibilities and timeless elements on a batch of songs that recall a bygone era of pure, heartfelt songwriting. With roots firmly planted in both the worlds of country and soul, Thompson once more demonstrates that there is no other living songwriter quite like him. We discussed his writing process, his thoughts on the music press, and the financial realities of the music business itself in 2026. That's Teddy Thompson on Into Music coming up now. If memory serves, this is your 10th solo album?
I think that's right, yeah.
Yeah, that's an impressive number, I suppose, to hit.
Yeah, it is, except I'm not what you would describe as prolific, so I guess really it should be a lot more. But that's pretty good going, isn't it? I mean, you know, the way things are now, it feels like an accomplishment to have made any records or to keep making records. It's such a slog.
I'm curious about the actual writing of it. So are you somebody who, you know, has maybe a concentrated period of writing and you come up with like 20 songs and then you whittle them down? Or when we hear 10 songs on an album, is that like, I really just focus my energy on making those the best I could?
Yeah, I would say the latter. I don't write that many songs, but when I think what I mean by that is that I don't finish that many songs. And I'm not sure that it's a very good practice, really, but it's where I ended up. So what I usually do is my pattern has been that I just sort of write songs all the time, a little bit, most of it in my head, actually, and lots of it from just, you know, I sit down, I have a guitar, you know, on my lap while I'm watching TV and stuff all the time. I mean, I pick it up all the time, but a lot of it's very unintentional and unfocused and not really strictly writing. It's just sort of noodling and almost like that sort of disassociative state of creativity where you're just half there and half not, which I find to be really, really fruitful. And then I guess the lazy part of the process for me is that I don't tend to then go to the next step, which is actually you need to sit down and finish all these ideas. What I tend to do is just have these ideas for songs or half finished songs or quarter finished songs, and they just roll around in my head for a long time, you know, months and years. And I do periodically, you know, go, oh, that, yeah, let me sit down and, you know, I pick up the guitar and I just make sure I don't forget that bit. And then, but then a lot of the fine tuning just comes from just having it in my head. And then essentially I just work on this survival of the fittest principle, which is that the songs that stick with me and that stay at the forefront of my consciousness or work their way to the forefront, I prioritize those and finish those.
It's interesting in the process. I write prose, and as a young man, I would just sit and labor and labor and labor, right? And I had a good friend who he would talk about something he was going to write for months, right? And then he would sit down and one draft, it was all there, and I thought, I'm working too hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's there's so many ways to do it that it's hard to or it, it's you can't really tell anybody which one way to do. You sort of have to figure it out for yourself, don't you? And figure out what works for you. And I have tried the sitting down and laboring and really trying to finish things. And sometimes it's good, but most of the time it didn't really work for me. But the other side of it is just practical. It's also just the circumstances the writer is living in, the world that they're living in, the era that they're living in. I think if you or I had been if we'd been working in a different era where, let's say for me it was like, the 60s, and I was, writing songs for other people, and it was kind of like, and I got invited down to the Brill Building, and hey, we have to finish this song today. Maybe I would be working differently if there were more demands on me, even if it was the 80s or 90s, and I was, selling lots of records, and they'd say, "Hey, we need the next record quick." I would probably work a lot quicker, and for other writers, I would imagine the same is true. But I think I've just fallen into this rhythm because I've been allowed to.
Do you remember your first kind of impulse to write?
I mean, I think I always had the idea that was part of the job, that if I was going to be a musician, that you had to be a writer as well. So it never really occurred to me that I would not be writing. So my ambitions to be a musician, to be a singer, to be a performer were definitely there from in the teenage years, but I wasn't particularly, if you'll forgive the choice of words, vocal about it. I was very, typically English. I didn't really tell people. We don't like to say things out loud because we're terrified of, failure. We don't like to advertise our ambition, manners and all that, self-deprecation. So yeah, I had the ambition to be a musician, and so with that, I knew that I had to be a writer. But I do remember, I hadn't really written and much at all as a teenager. I was late developer in that area, and I was playing music a little bit, and I was in bands in school. And then when I moved to LA when I was 18, 19, and I realized, I was like, wow, I really just haven't written anything proper at all. And the first song I wrote was on my first album, so that's where I started to write, because I wrote one song and people liked it, and I thought, and I was encouraged. And so, and then I had a bit of interest in from record labels at the time in the late 90s, and that prompted me to write some more songs.
And then at some point it becomes, okay, this or the architecture firm, right?
Yeah. Well, or then it became a bit more. I never really had. I wish I had an architecture degree, especially now. God, I wish I had any other skills. But at the time, no, it just became part of the habit. I think I needed that external validation for someone to say, "Wow, that's a great song." And I was like, "Wow, really? Okay." And then people got interested, and people heard about me, and they said, "Oh, this kid's pretty good." And then I thought, "Oh, wow. Well, okay, I'll let me write another song. I have some more." And then once I'd done that, then it just seemed like it became part of the routine to continue to write. And I was, I felt some love, in that department. And how important is that, right? To have somebody along the way, probably more than one person along the way. I mean, it goes all the way back to, your English teacher or something at school, and you need those little doses of encouragement all along the way to help you with your self-belief.
There comes that moment as well where maybe you get some praise from peers, and then you get praise maybe from somebody whose writing you've admired. And that, in my experience, is, I mean, that I could float on that for months, when it first happens,
I mean, I had, but I was also, I had, I didn't have that much of that, but a little bit, and most peers, mostly it was nice to be, I had a sort of little group of friends there who were also musicians. And yeah, when you play your song and they like it, you feel like you belong in that company, and that's really encouraging. But I also, I was always very enamored of my songwriting heroes. What one of the earliest was Chuck Berry, and I was not only did I was I enamored of his songwriting, I was also sort of really turned on by this pragmatic approach that he had, where it was very much like, yeah, I just wrote the songs for the money because I needed to make a record, and yeah, I just wrote that song on the train, and it was ve I was like, wait, it removed all this sort of mystery from the songwriting process, and it was like, yeah, it's a job. I just did it as my job, and of course, the songs were amazing, which does help. But I think it just helped with remove this veil of, oh, you need to be touched by some sort of inspiration or some sort of, hand from above that's gonna, or some state of being that you need to attain in order to channel the muses. Like, no, Chuck Berry just wrote 8 songs on the train on the way to the studio because they said they needed 10 songs and he had 2. I was like, that's so cool. So I really liked that thing too of just, yeah, pay me. It's a job. Are you gonna pay me to write a song? Well, now I'm motivated. Which is why I'm less motivated now, because no one's paying anymore. What am I doing this for?
One thing about your writing is your lines are, to me, always very clean and sort of fully realized, very careful. And I also love that when I think of your songs, they're not time-stamped. They're not populated by, I can't think of any of your songs, where you say, I woke up and wrote on her Facebook wall, And that seems to me to be a choice that you don't want to have things that are stuck in a moment.
I think an unconscious choice, certainly at the beginning, probably because all of my influences were from a bygone era. I didn't listen to any music that was of my generation when I was a kid, and I pretty much that went through to my mid-20s. So I was influenced by I guess, classic, quote unquote classic, songwriting and things that were of that style. I was just into a lot of country music, early country music, 50s, 60s, and Hank Williams, just the great stuff. I was exposed to good music, and I was interested. I liked that form of a classic song. I can't think of a better word than classic, but you know what I mean. And then I think I probably don't really know how to do that, to throw in the really contemporary lines. But I also don't particularly like the sound of it for me as a writing when I hear it go by. Or maybe I just feel like you need to be a kid. It needs to be authentic, I guess, is what it is. That's what it is. I'm just, sorry, reaching the point. I think it just comes down to authenticity. And if sometimes you hear someone do that, a lot of the time now you hear that, and to me it sounds so inauthentic. It's so, what's the word? Elbowed into the song, to try and sound contemporary or of the moment. So it's just about, but sometimes you'd hear it go by, and it would make sense. But it doesn't make sense for me, so I'm not going to try and do it. It's just not how I guess how I write. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think about country music, I don't know, it just comes to mind right now, the song There Stands the Glass, right?
Yeah.
Everybody knows what a glass is. Everybody knows what it feels like to try to drown their sorrows. That's all you need.
There stands the emoji. There stands the Pokemon. It doesn't have the same ring to it, does it? But maybe that's just us. I don't know. Maybe the kids. Maybe that's, now this then the generation, the sort of Gen Z kids don't drink anymore. So maybe There Stands the Glass is not going to be so resonant for them. They're going to have to be songs about vaping and weed. There stands the vape.
I hear it. It's got potential. So on this record, you have David, who you've worked with quite extensively. I think you've also worked extensively with Tony Scher, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This must be this thing where it's like, these relationships work. I know what I'm getting. I trust these people and they understand what I'm about.
Yeah, I think more so for, well, trust, yes. But I don't know if they, I don't know if I would say they understand me exactly, because I don't feel like, and this could just be, you know, it's we don't know what we look like, as somebody once said to me. We have no idea what we look like. So I think of myself as being not particularly fitting into any one genre and being a bit hard to categorize. And I include the musical process in that of like, yeah, I want it like this, but I want this sort of thing of having to try to sort of find a new way of, you know, my own way of creating the sound. So when it comes to the role of producer with David Mansfield, for example, for this record, it's not a case of, oh, he knows exactly who I am and what I want, because I don't think I know exactly who I am or know who I am or what I want either. And when it comes to my own records, and certainly this one, I feel like I don't necessarily want the standard obvious thing in this section. I don't want the instrumentation that might be expected here. I want something a bit different. So it's not that he knows what to do. It's that he knows how to figure it out with me, and that he's just, you know, he's so capable of doing that. So that's the best part of that relationship, and it is tremendous. David's an amazing guy. He's always been an amazing musician, which those who know him will know, starting with the Rolling Thunder Review. He was on tour with Bob Dylan when he was 17 or something. So that was there very early on. But he's also taught himself really to be an incredible producer, which is a pretty amazing thing to, he's a learner, you know, he's an autodidact, and he's somebody who has taught himself throughout his life and will just turn his hand or his eye to something and figure out how to do it. And he did that with record producing, which is, you know, to me, an incredible thing to do, and especially, you know, in your 60s, be like, oh, okay, now I'll just figure out how to do this. So for a lot of the time, it was just he and I in the room, and he was able to just do everything himself, you know, create the sounds, play the sounds, you know, come up with different stuff and go back and forth with me and try things and erase things and start things again, with just the most fantastic open mind and intuitiveness. I can't speak highly enough of David. And then when it comes to musicians, like Tony Scher is just, he's just, I was going to say infallible, but that's sort of a terrible word to use for music, because music should have fallibility in it. So let me think of something else for Tony. He just knows what to play. He always does the right thing, even when the right thing is something that's a total surprise. It's just really, you know, he's of that caliber of musician. You know, he's up there with the very best people I've ever seen or played with. Truly, he's like, you could put him up there with Pino Palladino or Jim Keltner or Richard Thompson or anything, and he's as good as any of them. That's how good he is. And to have that for a bass player is, as I'm sure you know, if you play any kind of music, it's something. It's the bedrock. You know, it's just the most. It's so important.
Absolutely. Well, on that kind of little bit unexpected, you have John Grant on the album. Was your first time working with him like on the Proxy Music album, or had you known him before that?
Well, we're friends, so I had known him before that, and we have we just had people in common in you know, a while back, I guess, when his first record came out, the Queen of Denmark record. I think we had the same publicist or something in London, and they played me that record gave me that record. And I was just, as so many were, I was almost literally on the floor. I was like, what the fuck is this? Because I didn't know anything about the Czars or anything. He was all new to me. So, I made sure that I met him, and we became good friends, which is nice. And, As great as he is, he's an even finer human being. So I'm pleased to know him, glad to know him, and call him a friend, and to be able to call him on the phone as a friend and say, "Listen, would you play on my record?" And I don't do that. It gives me the willies to do that to anybody because again, I'm so English, and it makes me uncomfortable to cross the line, to ask a friend to do something that's really work, or that's, and even more complex, that's creative work, because it's, I guess it's, there's the possibility for things to not go perfectly, or for feelings to get hurt, or things, it's a bit of unknown. So I was wary of it, but I'm so glad I did, because honestly, I think because I have been such a fan of his music for so long, his sound had seeped into my creative being, and I realized that I was looking for some John Grant type sounds on this record because I've listened to him so much, and oops, I can't help it. He's an influence now. And I couldn't find anybody else to do John Grant sounds. Actually tried a couple of people, and it was not good. And then I thought, well, I think I have to ask John Grant to make John Grant sounds.
If you have the number, why not?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, just briefly, as that Queen of Denmark album was, that was one of those records where I paused and I was like, I needed this, you know?
Yeah, it was really quite seminal for me. It was just the most incredible meeting of sort of, well, it's reductive to say, but it was a bit like, because it was, it was who's the Midlake band, so it was sort of rootsy almost and real as far as instrumentation and sounds going, very live and real, and a little bit, folksy country, however you want to put to frame Midlake, with this, sort of synth theme modern sound. And then, the most important thing of all was just the amazing songs. But sound wise, yeah, to have the meeting of these two worlds, to me, was just like sort of what I'd always wanted. But I didn't know how, that it, maybe it didn't exist yet. I'm like, wow, yeah, this is exactly what I'm looking for.
You kind of touched on this a little bit earlier briefly, but my sense is that the more people I talk to, and I every day when I look around, this is a very strange moment in music making, I think. I think it's, the old systems have definitely dissipated in terms of how a record gets heard and everything like that. How do you kind of keep going now compared to when you started, let's say in the, late 90s, early 2000s?
Yeah, it's difficult. It's sort of, it's really unsustainable. I'm sorry to say, is how it feels for me. I mean, every time I make another record, I don't really know how I managed to do it, and I don't really know where the money came from. I just sort of, made it happen, and it's like working with, less and less every time, so it seems. Maybe that's plateaued a little bit, actually. Maybe it's about the same now as it has been for the last few. But essentially, it's like music is really a part-time job now, and that's not the end of the world, except that I don't have a full-time job because I didn't get that architecture degree, and that's a difficult situation for a lot of us to be in. It's not so much that we are, unwilling to change the way we do things. It's that we are unhirable in any other field, and we didn't get any skills or qualifications to do anything else to fall back on. So we're just forced to double down and just do it. So it's like doing the same job just for less and less, essentially, which is a weird thing. I think it's hard for people to really understand that. But I guess if you were, it would be just like if you have been a lawyer for 30 years and you always made $200,000 a year, and then all of a sudden lawyers stop getting paid that much. This would actually be great, wouldn't it? But you know what I mean. So it's like if any job is, oh, let me just try and explain this. Like you made that. Then it was like, no, now you make $100,000. Now you only make $50,000 a year being a lawyer, and you have no other skills, and you couldn't get a job at Starbucks because you've never had any other experience. That's what it's like. So we're just left here, sort of doing it, you know, because we have no other choice. We still want to do it, but it's very tough because there's not a lot of money involved. So we're at the mercy of people that, or the, you know, the kindness of strangers a bit. You know, there's still people who support music who give more than they need to, and people who fund certain things, and so we're. It's that, but it's a bit of a shame because do we want music to become that sort of rarefied, subsidized art form that so many other things are? Because then the barrier to entry is so high, right?
Well, I'll close on this. Of course, the record is not out yet. I'm guessing maybe it's making the rounds with, critics and so forth who are getting review copies, and a little bit of airplay as singles have come out. What is that period like for you when you finish an album and then you're waiting for like the verdict, let's say?
Yeah, good question. It's yeah, I think it's it doesn't cause me too much stress because it doesn't I don't it's not that impactful really, which is the good news and the bad news, because unfortunately there's not much that anybody can do or say, and I mean critics and or even people like your good self or anybody else that's writing or talking about the record. There's not that much that anyone can say to move the needle one way or the other, unfortunately and fortunately. So nobody's going to destroy my expected sales or expected touring experience with this record by giving me any terrible review. But unfortunately, no one's going to. It's not giving me some amazing review might not help that much either. So it's just sort of, it's a bit of a nothing time. You just enjoy talking about it and hearing things go by, and then you hope for something great to happen. It's just what most people who are putting out records now, they go through the process, they do all the work, and it's kind of, you have fun with it, doing the artwork and stuff. That's fun, but cool, yeah. And then, you hope for a piece or two of good luck along the way, because that's what it amounts to now. There's not much that anyone can do to really, boost sales or get new fans when you're an adult artist, when you're not a kid. So yeah, we just do our jobs and hope for the best. Hope that Burger King is looking for a sort of middle-aged, mid-tempo heartbreak song for their new Whopper campaign.
You've been listening to a conversation with Teddy Thompson. His new album, Never Be the Same, is out May 15th on the Royal Potato Family label. You can learn more about him, including upcoming tour dates, at his website, teddythompson.net. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, kmuw.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@kmuw.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torrin Anderson.